From the Sky News Centre at 6. Ambulances are being diverted and hospital phone lines are down after a cyber attack on the NHS. More than 16 organisations in England are affected, along with several GP practices in Scotland. Unison's National Officer for Ambulance Staff, Alan Lofthouse, says they'll still do their best for patients.
Whilst the diverts are not ideal, they do quite often work with diversions from hospitals when they reach capacity and they have to divert because they haven't got any free beds. So ambulance staff are well trained in what to do in these situations, and we know that they will step up to the mark.
It's understood files have been locked by hackers who are demanding a payment. Several trusts have turned off their IT systems completely, reverting to pen and paper. So far, there's no evidence that patient data has been accessed. Cybercrime journalist Tony Morbin says that information would be particularly valuable.
Unlike your bank account details or any other details, passwords and so on, you can't just change it. Your health data is actually going to stay with you whatever happens. So they resell this information on, and they can sell it for years to come.
Also this evening, the deaths of three people in the Democratic Republic of Congo are being linked to Ebola. The World Health Organization says it's taking the situation very seriously and describes it as an outbreak. Jeremy Corbyn's given a big speech on defence during today's election campaign, saying he accepts military action as a genuine last resort. Theresa May has accused Labour of abandoning traditional working class voters. The FTSE's ended the day up 48 points at a record closing high of 74.35. It's been helped by big gains for AstraZeneca, which has revealed a substance it's trialling has been shown to reduce the risk of death in people with advanced lung cancer. In sport, Chelsea have their first chance to win this season's Premier League title tonight. They're at West Brom, knowing victory would make them champions with two games to spare. Celtic go to Aberdeen in the Scottish Premiership. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
The public cannot comprehend this weapon and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong. But because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help, and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, Kevin Carhill and me, Tony Gosling. Police sweep barracks across Germany after uncovering a neo-Nazi terrorist cell in the army. Isn't that news? Yes, a nationwide sweep in Germany of army barracks serving soldiers are discovered with Nazi memorabilia. Meanwhile, an arrested German soldier has planned to blame his own terror attack on Syrian refugees. Quite a sophisticated cell within the German army. Also, former Rothschild banker Macron is the next French president. Like the US election, are the French people being given the choice between a fascist or neoliberal nutcase when they don't want either? North Korea in the news again as the US puts its THAAD missile systems in. Have you seen the South Korean protests on our news? Is THAAD a defensive system? If so, what's the problem? We also look at this week's South Korean elections and ask, is there any real danger in threats by Kim Jong-il and Donald Trump to start a nuclear war? Is it just saber-rattling? Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, homeless people from Bristol's Tent Village have set up shop. Now we speak to ex-serviceman Stuart, who lives there. He explains why over a year ago he left the violence and abusive behaviour of a homeless hostel, as others have, to live in a tent. Also, off to Joseph Mengele's merry old China, where people of faith and other prisoners of conscience are being executed by having their organs harvested for profit by the government. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or, if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin and Kevin, I'd just like to bring up that item that we heard in the news there about the cyber attack on the National Health Service again. I know we mentioned it in the last hour, but it basically occurs to me, why is it that someone can't immediately get to the root of the problem by probing this bank account that everyone's supposed to be putting their money into that's part of this hack? Because surely that would lead them immediately to the people who are behind it. Kevin, you first.
Again, there are all sorts of questions like that that need to be asked. Oddly, computer crime in one sense ought to be the easiest to detect, precisely how you have said. You can follow the trail. It doesn't get burnt. You know, it's there. It may be complicated, but it is there.
The banks will probably say, oh, well, I'm sorry, that information's confidential, when the police knock on their door or phone them up.
This is where you get caught in a contradiction about the police, you know, having these new powers to dive into anything they want and put surveillance on everything, but they don't seem able to use it when there's a crisis there. This is the real question. The powers are all there in the law. Why aren't they working?
I think the other thing is the police will say, well, it can take us weeks to get access to a bank to get all the correct approvals for them to tell us who, for example, the signatures are on this bank account where the people are being asked at the National Health Service right now to put money into that account, and yet the police can't find out probably for weeks who the signatories are and where the money would be then transferred to.
Yeah, but again, that's an excuse I've never understood. If the police have, a drug suspect, something more obvious, they get a warrant from a magistrate in 4 hours. Mm. What's the problem,
Martin? What do you make of this? Let's just try and grapple with this story that's in the news today.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with legitimate law enforcement being able to find out whatever they need to find out, you know, hard drives, whatever they need to look at. But this general surveillance of the population to stop terrorism is I mean, we've already got all the powers that the police need to investigate crime already exist. They've been on the statute book forever. They don't need extra powers. That's absurd. And of course, Theresa May is very much part of one of those that's been pushing for extra powers to prevent terrorist attacks and so on. Well, now, of course, the real problem is that the terrorists may be inside the structure, as we're going to discuss in a moment about what's been going on in Germany. And the real problem there is not the powers of the police to investigate. It's that they don't want to investigate because the people they're investigating are too powerful and are able to tell them to back off.
Yeah, further up the chain.
Okay, so but yes. Sorry, Kevin, go on.
No. Theresa May got the Investigatory Powers Act on the statute book. That act can't work. Mass surveillance that is included in the act, bulk collection, they call it, same thing, is a breach of the most basic rights in the European Charter of Human Rights. So, of course, her other plot is to take the UK out not only of the EU, but out of the European Council, the Council of Europe. And so that there's no... We, the people of Britain, are victims of this.
Let me just make it clear, because certainly the stuff I've read is that it looks like for at least the next 10 years, Britain will be staying in the European Court of Human Rights, but not in the European Court of Justice, which is the thing they've got the big beef with. For example, the European Court of Justice has just ruled that any employer can sack someone from wearing a headscarf. And they say it's not religious discrimination. So there are two different separate courts.
Yeah, no, they're totally... And most people don't understand the distinction. However, the court that convicted her American friends of mass surveillance and criminal activity was the European Court of Justice, not the Human Rights Court. The case never went there. No wonder she's anxious to get out from under it.
Sounds like a whole load of legal juggling just to get around the law. Anyway, let's get on to this German army calling for searches of all barracks after Nazi memorabilia is found. This is the head of Germany's armed forces called for an inspection of all army barracks after investigators discovered neo-Nazi military memorabilia in a garrison, broadening a scandal about right-wing extremism amongst soldiers. The discovery at barracks in Dönitzschingen in, if I pronounced that right, Donaueschingen, I think that's probably the best way to say it, in southwest Germany, made an investigation that began after similar Nazi-era items were found in the garrison of an army officer arrested on suspicion of planning a racially motivated attack. As a result, General Inspector Volker Wieker, he has ordered a wider search of barracks right across the country. So, Martin, this has also been sanctioned by Defence Secretary Ursula von der Leyen. She said the military must root out all right-wing extremism. And yet, this is actually very serious, isn't it? We're talking about not necessarily neo-Nazis, but Nazis. We're talking about soldiers who are venerating Hitler, actually serving soldiers right now within the German army.
Well, what interests me about this is what are the connections of this guy? I think the police have done a very good job to catch the individual, because he'd already stashed a pistol in Vienna Airport. The plan was that he was going to turn up, pick up this pistol, carry out an attack. The pistol would then be left, and he would escape. And a big question in my mind: how would you escape? He must have had some means, because of course if he was arrested on the spot red-handed, then they wouldn't have been able. And what he'd done previously is, as a serving German army officer, he'd gone and pretended to be a Syrian asylum seeker, given his fingerprints to the the people that deal with these things, so that it would then appear to be an asylum seeker who had carried out the attack. And of course, he then would have escaped from Vienna Airport, and presumably his thing would not have been traced. Now, in other words, he would have been protected. Now, we know similar things have happened in Germany in the past. So, for example, a few years ago, there were assassinations of various Turkish shopkeepers and so on. And the way it was investigated by the police was that it was some kind of internal feud in the Turkish community. And it was eventually uncovered that these assassinations, 10 or 12, had been carried out by neo-Nazis and had been protected by the BND, the German intelligence services. And of course, this fits a pattern going back decades of Western intelligence services being involved in false flag terrorism.
Well, von der Leyen said the military had not taken the threat of right-wing extremism seriously enough. She says you have reason to dig deeper to the military. She said, noting that 18 members of the armed forces had been dismissed for right-wing extremist views since 2012. But Kevin, this is we have not been told his rank, but he was an officer who managed, with others, they believe, to squirrel away at least 1,000 rounds of ammunition.
Yeah, if you're in a military force, officer or any other rank, it's not that difficult. The problem with... One of the post-war crimes against the population of Europe, media-type crimes, was the division of the German army into the bad Wehrmacht and the bad SS and the good Wehrmacht. If you were a Russian, they were all the same. They were all fascists, because they murdered most Russians they ever met.
So they weren't very good at treating Russian prisoners of war well,
no.
Were they?
And this was the Wehrmacht. This wasn't the SS. So the German army is still contaminated from World War II, but I see the
isn't
hand
it,
I mean, of...
Isn't it about time that the German army surrendered to the Russians? Because they refused to do that at the end of the Second World War, Martin, didn't they? They surrendered to the Allies, that is the British and the Americans, but they never did to Moscow.
Yeah, I think there's...
No, can I correct you? Do you
Sorry,
mind?
I'm not quite sure.
The person who translated the German surrender in Berlin was a man called Boris Brattes, a friend of mine. He was Zhukov's translator. And from when we were at college, we didn't know who he was. But he had a photographic memory, and he gave us the German surrender word for word.
Oh, so they
no,
did.
The Germans did surrender to the Russians in Berlin.
I think maybe I'm getting a bit confused with the Japanese, Singapore maybe, something like that.
Who never surrendered to the Russians. Yes, they have never. There's a ceasefire, but no peace treaty.
And also, of course, the situation we'll be coming on to a bit later with North and South Korea, Martin.
There's just a ceasefire there.
I probe I suspect that the sudden urge to clean up the German army is coming from Merkel. Merkel has realised there's a problem. taken her a while to wake up, I think. But there is a problem.
Can I just say, and it's not just that the German army has got the recidivist Nazis in it. What worries me is that this is part of a general pattern of Western intelligence services, not just the German intelligence services, also MI6 and the CIA, are fomenting both right-wing and left-wing terrorism. Just think if this guy had managed to succeed in what he wanted to do. He's carried out an attack in Vienna airport, he's killed loads of random tourists, he's escaped, and of course the word goes out that this is another terrorist attack by these evil Muslims from Syria, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And of course it may well be that the previous attacks that we've seen are of exactly this kind.
Exactly. We heard last week, Martin, didn't we, about the Dortmund bus attack actually being done by somebody who was actually just a criminal who was trying to make money, not a terrorist at all. They're just an ordinary criminal.
Well, also, I'd like to mention, if we're going to mention Dortmund, the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre in 1980, which the police eventually uncovered was actually carried out by NATO intelligence services as part of Operation Gladio. Now, we know, because we've had decades of investigation of this, that NATO intelligence services routinely engage in terrorist activities. The bombing of Bologna railway station, again in 1980, Italian police absolutely convinced that was carried out by NATO. The same NATO that Theresa May thinks that we've absolutely got to be a part of, otherwise Jeremy Corbyn will prevent us from being part of it, and so on and so forth. People need to know the history of NATO. NATO is, as Donald Trump said, obsolete, except he's changed his mind
What do you make of NATO, Kevin?
It's what it has always been. It's an instrument of the United States to create tension with Russia so the United States arms industry can sell arms to Europe. During the presidential campaign, the one thing that got the Americans panicked was when Trump was saying the NATO allies are going to have to start paying up. They already do. The biggest trade imbalance in the world is the military one, because most of the NATO forces buy American weapons. It's just a way of raising the tensions so that weapons are sold by the Americans to NATO.
I mean, this trade, this imbalance almost seems to be going alongside this social imbalance. That is, when we talk about equality a lot, we talk about all sorts of different types of sexual equality, this kind of thing, equal marriage. But we don't hear anywhere near enough, in my mind, about basic equality of income, where people do not have enough money to live on. Mm. We'll be hearing on Dialect on next Tuesday noon about the people who are having to live in tents, certainly not out of their own choice, here in Bristol today. And just getting back to the rich list again for a minute, Kevin, one of the things that has come out of that is that this year's 500 richest individuals and families are now wealthier than the entire top 1,000 were last year. So, you know, their wealth is increasing at exponential rates, while for the vast majority, for example, if you check this stuff out, that work is actually no longer a route out of poverty, according to the... I mean, we've got nearly two-thirds of children now living in poverty in working families, and most people classes now in poverty in Britain have got a job.
Yeah, what Theresa May is really demanding a strong mandate for is because she's going to have three huge problems. She's going to have the cost of Brexit and then the job losses. Then she's going to have the cost of the NHS, and then she's going to have the cost of social services, and she's going to want to be able to ignore all those three crises.
I mean, Martin, is what we're looking at here, slowly but surely in many countries right across the West, particularly after 2008, the idea that the state is not really needed or wanted, the idea that because it's so massively in debt, let's just push the state out of the way. I mean, that devalues our vote every year, doesn't it, if that is what's going on?
Well, effectively, when the state stepped in and bailed out the private financial markets in 2008, we basically gave them a blank check. Philip Mirovsky, the professor in the US, has written some very good stuff about this. And of course, the reason why the wealthiest have had their wealth increasing so rapidly is because of this stock market bubble that's all based on money printing. And the money printing isn't being used to keep to keep the poor in necessities. It's being used to build up asset prices so that the super wealthy can carry on raking it in. And of course, it's going to crash. That's the other thing that's going to happen. It's not just because of Brexit. There's going to be a crash. It may start in Wall Street like it did last time. It'll be a US crash, not a European crash. It won't be to do with the euro. And we're all going to, and at that point, of course, what Theresa May hopes is she's
going to... You've
been
saying that for 8 years.
Well, yes, because, of course, it only happens once. Right, yeah. But it's still... It's like building a bonfire in Northern Ireland. You just build a bonfire and build a bonfire and build a bonfire, and it only goes off when you put it, when you put a match to it. And, of course, it, but that bonfire is definitely there. There is no basis for the stock prices we're now seeing. They're way above the normal price to earnings ratio that you would expect in a normal market.
Kevin, what do you make of this phenomenon now where we hear from people like the Joseph Rowntree Trust, a great article on politics.co.uk, which the headline is "The Myth That Work Pays Is Finally Exposed." For many people, as soon as they get into work, they're also immediately suffering with the withdrawal of benefits. And nowadays, you know, you've got to have probably two people in order to pay the rent and the bills in a house in a low paid job. It's really, really difficult to get, not only to get your foot on the work ladder, but also on the housing ladder. It's almost impossible.
It's, well, again, there was no analysis at the time. It was quite clear in Thatcher's time that she wanted people back in rented accommodation because they are much more vulnerable than people. People who own their own homes have a certain stake, and they're a bit bulgier, and they've got something to lose. If you're in rented accommodation, you'll be fearful for your job. And this is the Tory fear programme. Make the public fearful, and then they can be manipulated so easily.
Yeah, I think that they certainly want to create fear. I think decent rented accommodation of council housing kind doesn't fulfil that. You know, that gave people a bit of security. People in private rented, I mean, basically, we are the taxpayers who are paying VAT on everything they buy are subsidising private landlords who are their own landlords. Yeah. And, of course, they're not actually getting anything from that at all.
Okay,
it's just free money from the government for the landlords.
Martin talks about the Spirit Level book on here quite a bit. And one of the authors of that is also the founder of something called the Equality Trust, Professor Kate Pickett. Now, there was a very rare appearance of her on the BBC recently on the Nikki Campbell programme. So let's have a listen to what Professor Kate Pickett has got to say about the inequalities today.
If I were the architect of universal credit and responsible for some of this welfare reform, I would not be sleeping at night. We should not be relying on charities to prop up our social security system. That's an opinion. Now I'm going to speak as a scientist. What we're seeing as a consequence of welfare reform is rising child poverty, and soon we're going to have one in four of all of our children living in poverty, two-thirds of them in houses where somebody works. We're seeing rising infant mortality for the first time in decades. We're seeing a rise in deaths among the frail elderly. Tens of thousands. Now, speaking as a citizen, I think we should be outraged at the immorality of those reforms. We should be piling up the body bags in those tiny infant coffins outside number 10 and number 11 Downing Street and making our Prime Minister and Chancellor walk that gamut every day. Because it's outrageous what we're doing. We are punishing the poorest. We are punishing the disabled, we are punishing the sick, and we are doing it at levels unseen of in this country since the end of the Second World War. We should be ashamed of what we're doing.
Well, obviously, I agree with that, and her book was very interesting because she wrote it with Richard Wilson, as they say, and what they show in that book is it's massively full of statistics and graphs, and it's an overwhelming argument. It was a bestseller because it points out that the more equal your society is, the better off everybody is, and they tentatively put forward a hypothesis for this. We are basically status conscious animals. We're very conscious of our status in relation to others, and that's why more equal societies are much happier societies, because it's not just a question of poor people having the basics. If they've got the basics, but they're still not, they don't feel as if they can participate, then they get mentally ill, they get sick, and so forth. So, for example, with children who go to school who can't afford to go on trips or to do the extra clubs and all the rest of it, they start feeling inferior, having health problems at that early stage. And another interesting fact from the book was in societies that are more equal, like Sweden or Norway, the wealthier are better off. because in actual fact they have less stress, they pay their taxes, and then they feel good about themselves, and in actual fact they feel better off. But we've forgotten all of this because of the deliberate pursuit of inequality by the right wing.
I wonder, are we, and it's not us, if you like, but I wonder if this is the mistake Jeremy Corbyn is making. He seems to me to be slightly pitching his message at the, you know, underprivileged, those who are at the sharp, you know, at the rough end of things. Mm-hmm. But the people, the majority, probably are well off. And maybe he should be turning it around and pitching to get them to join him in doing something about this rising poverty and...
Well, you know what's underpinning that? Is the electoral system. In Ireland, as you well know, you can't form a government unless you've got a pretty big consensus. So you can't do it. In Britain, because of the system that we've had for years, it's designed to entrench Tory governments. If it's a few hundred thousand people in swing constituencies around London decide general elections. They don't decide them in France, they don't decide them in Germany, they don't decide them in Ireland, and in the future they won't decide them in Scotland either.
It looks as if we're coming back round again to talking about the tax havens, and there is a film coming out soon. There's a trailer for it online, which I was watching last week. It's called The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire, which is the tax havens. So let's have a listen to a clip from the trailer now.
The reality is not what you believe, that your prime minister has the power to decide on the future of your country. The power is hidden here.
I had complete access to all the client files, and this is what I found. There were some insider traders, some market rigging, some avoiding disclosure of conflicts of interest, illicit arms trading, illicit political campaign donations, contract kickbacks, bribery, fraudulent invoicing, trade mispricing, and at the bottom, tax evasion.
If you come from the same kind of background, you know the right people, then all the kind of legal niceties will often fall away. You can get away with doing all sorts of things.
That's a clip there from the forthcoming film, which is called The Spider's Web. And we heard there, Martin, from John Christensen, and he's talking about all the various types of transactions that were going on where he was working in the Channel Islands for effectively a kind of tax evasion, tax avoidance company, some sort of accounting job. But he could see the money was going to all these sorts of illicit purposes, including things like dodgy arms deals.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things, we've had some exposure of tax havens in recent years, but then again, there's manipulation going on there, because the Nevada is now becoming a major tax haven, and of course they don't get the scrutiny that the British tax havens are getting. So there's a kind of attempt to make some tax havens sound bad and other tax havens are less so.
Yeah, we don't hear a lot about Switzerland either, which is a massive tax haven, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, the United Kingdom, in effect, is also a tax haven itself, you know. Mentioning Second Empire and tax havens, I think if you saw Who Owns the World, that was one of the chapters in it, was that Britain has this peculiar structure where a great deal of the world's cash is. You've touched on this a couple of times yourself. The City of London needs the tax havens for the cash.
Yeah.
And you know, they're all headed by the Queen.
Sorry, who are?
Most of our tax havens.
Oh, the tax havens, yeah.
Crown dependencies.
Yes, that's right. And she's responsible for appointing all the people to govern these places. So she's in quite a good position to maybe do something about the tax havens. The only trouble is she avoiding tax?
Well, since unfortunately, unlike... One of the good things about the rich list is at least we know who they are. So if we really wanted, we could talk to these people. In the case of the Queen, her status has been completely hidden. We don't know. The only thing we know she owns is the Crown Estate, because the Tories gave it to her when they became the coalition government.
But yet that is not included in the rich list. What?
No.
Why is that?
Well, it appears prior to that, the palace had phoned Murdoch
Yeah, so they managed to get it out, but even now it should be in. It's still not there. I mean, it sounds like the Queen's got quite a lot of... but anyway, you were kind of dodging my question a bit. Is the Queen got a lot of money in tax havens?
Well, as she owns quite a few of them, wouldn't it be a surprise if she didn't?
Okay. All right. So also then, let's have a listen now also to, on a similar theme, this is a clip from a while back, actually, but it kept popping up into my mind. It's talking to somebody that Martin and I have known through the 9/11 Truth movement. His name's Justin Walker, and he's the nephew of one of the directors of the Bank of England back in 1972 by the name of Harry Pilkington. And Harry gave Justin some advice as a young lad. Let's have a listen to that. This is Justin telling us about that a couple of months ago.
My journey started back in 1972. I was going back to school. I was on a train. I was with my uncle, and he was Sir Harry Pilkington, later Lord Pilkington. He went to the very first Bilderberg conference in 1954. I didn't know that until only a few years ago. But I did know he was the director of the Bank of England from 1955 to 1972. And this was 1972, and he was actually travelling down to London to go to one of his last meetings at the Bank of England. We were just talking about general subjects when he suddenly stopped me dead and said, what are you doing when you leave school? And I was only 16, and I was going down to do my O-levels and stuff. And he said, I'm going to give you two pieces of advice to take through life. First of all, never believe anything you read in the press, because we control it. And secondly, never ever believe a politician when they say they can do something, because they can't unless we say they can.
Well, that's a bit damning, Martin. I mean, I suppose people will point the finger at Justin Walker and say, oh, well, he's a 9/11 truther, he's a conspiracy theorist.
Well, that may be... that's frankly true. So's Donald Trump, but he's the President of the United States. And on that point, of course, Trump on the day of 9/11 actually said, well, because I build these buildings, there must have been bombs in the buildings.
Let's get back to the point here, which is the Bank of England. He's saying they're controlling press and also controlling political parties.
Well, the question that comes to mind when I hear that quote is, who's we that he's talking about? Because it isn't we.
The Bank of England. He's talking about the city.
No, I don't think he's talking about the city of London.
I'd say he's talking about the establishment.
Yeah, in a more general way.
Okay, so obviously the establishment includes the Bank of England. Where else? Maybe the monarchy?
The monarchy in particular. Because the monarchy was intimately involved in the creation of the tax havens. They kind of grew up amongst courtiers. You know, they needed somewhere to stash a few illicit pounds. And what better than, you know, Jersey or the Bahamas or wherever. So... But the establishment, as what was it, Anthony Sampson defined it, would be the Bank of England, the security services. They are big in the equation. And, of course, have you noticed our media reporting that GCHQ is now in the hands of MI5? Nobody seemed to notice. The deputy head of MI5 has just become the head of GCHQ. The chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee, which would be central to what Pilkington was warning about, tried to defend American spying in Britain in an affidavit. We're not talking about opinions here or conspiracy theories. This guy put in an affidavit to court saying, well, it was legal in America, so it was okay here. Kind of, no, actually, it isn't. The laws that apply here are ours.
Martin, I mean, anyone listening to that will think, well, what's the point in voting, you know, if the press and politicians are all owned by the establishment?
Well, there is an issue. I mean, there have been various attempts to, you know, in Northern Ireland, for example, to boycott. But of course...
We're trying to encourage young people to register to vote here. In fact, we'll put a link up on our show page.
The only thing I would say is this, that not voting doesn't achieve anything. Voting doesn't achieve much, but not voting will achieve nothing at all. So let's get clear about this. And just coming back to the whole tax haven thing, what Philip Hammond was hinting was that if we don't get a good deal on Brexit, whatever that means, we might turn Britain into a tax haven, which it already is. And, of course, the response from Merkel to that was, don't try and threaten us. And, of course, when and if Angela Prime Minister Theresa May tries to negotiate with the European Union leaders, if she tries that kind of tactic, if you don't give us a good deal, we're gonna just let rip on having tax havens in Britain. Their response to that is, no, you're not. We're going to close you down, and we'll get a terrible deal on things like car imports and so on and so forth. And threatening people before you negotiate them, it is part of a negotiating tactic. But of course, the Republican movement in Northern Ireland are going to be threatening you from behind, and of course, so are the Scottish National Party.
No, but there's a more immediate. The president of the European Commission is the arch tax dodger himself, a Juncker. He signed more dodgy tax deals when he was Prime Minister of Luxembourg than probably all our tax havens ever did. He was the master of the tax dodge. So why do we expect him to do anything spectacular about... My hunch would be that he's a bit worried, because Luxembourg was part of the structure of tax-dodging tax havens.
The German tax police did invade Luxembourg, didn't they, a few years ago? They just turned up mob-handed and went through all of their hard drives, because it's only a tiny little country. And ultimately, of course, what General de Gaulle did with Monaco in 1962 is he knew that lots of people were using it as a tax haven, so he just sealed the border with the military and said, nobody's coming in or out of Monaco until you tell us how much money you've got. And I think when you know, the murd hits the fan, as it will, as I've suggested, governments are going to get much more serious about collecting their taxes. They'll have to. That'll be very much part of what has to happen.
OK, let's run through some of the international stories now, just quickly, both of you. First of all, Syria doctors apparently are crowdfunding underground hospitals over there. That is to say that they're putting out appeals online for people to crowdfund hospitals inside Syria. Now, Kevin, this seems a bit of a desperate measure. Is it strange that the international aid agencies are having so much difficulty actually getting help through to Syria?
Now, Syria is one of the most complicated areas, as I understand the few people I've met who've been there. To get any kind of aid through is a nightmare. It's worse than most places. But I missed this. Is it the aid agencies are crowdfunding?
No, this is the
source of the report.
The doctors themselves, actually, over in Syria.
Are the doctors in the government-controlled areas, or the doctors in the rebel-controlled areas, like the White Helmets?
Several heavily populated parts of the country, hospitals have repeatedly been damaged and some sites destroyed outright. Obviously, repairs are constantly underway, but doctors in the same parts of the country have come up with a novel solution, relocating underground. Hama has one of the earliest and best examples.
That's under rebel control.
Okay.
Now, in actual fact, we've got sanctions on Syria. We, the British, have got sanctions on Syria along with lots of other countries, which means, of course, that the Syria 90% of the population are in government-controlled areas, and they have real problems because we won't supply them with any drugs or any help of any kind. That's one of the things that the Syrian people have to put up with. This is another manipulation, because crowdfunding says, isn't it terrible? They've got to have crowdfunding in Syria. Now, in actual fact, the White Helmets are a psychological warfare operation run by the Western intelligence services.
Also in Idlib province as well.
That's another rebel-controlled area.
Okay, this,
so in other words, we're talking about in rebel-controlled areas, the Russians are bombing hospitals deliberately, although there's been no evidence to suggest that, and now they're having to crowdfund. How awful is that? Now, 90% of the population are in government-controlled areas. The White Helmets are a psychological warfare operation. The Swedish Doctors for Human Rights...
The origin of the story is actually The Guardian.
The Guardian will have got it from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is actually a British-funded individual living in Coventry who hasn't been inside Syria in the last 20 years. There's an awful lot of lies and nonsense talked about what's been going on in Syria. Mm. And the fact is that Syria is under siege by the NATO powers and the Gulf states. And millions of people have been displaced, and hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. And this is actually a war crime. And of course, James Le Mesurier, who set up the White Helmets, is based in Turkey. He's a British psychological warfare operations officer, and his funding all comes from the British government. We pay for this. And the Swedish Committee of Human Rights, they're all doctors. They've analysed the videos put out by the White Helmets to say not only are the White Helmets not helping children in these videos, they're actually murdering children in these videos and pretending to help them. That's what we fund. And of course, we're going to war with Syria if Theresa wins the election. But of course, it's not going to be a pushover. They're going to fight back, and they're going to fight back hard. They've taken hundreds of thousands of casualties in the Syrian army. And let's just see how the British Army takes can face up to that.
Well, so it's interesting the Guardian isn't really saying which areas these are in, but yeah, you're quite right, Martin. It's in rebel-held areas. The Guardian is saying
the information from the British psychological warfare officers.
We should be crowdfunding these hospitals, the rebel-held. But mind you, of course, you know, anyone that's been killed or injured on any side should be being given help of some sort. Southern Yemen leaders, we hear today also, are launching body seeking a split from the north. Senior tribal military and political leaders have formed a new council seeking secession of southern Yemen. The former government of the area's main city, Aden, said on Thursday, threatening to bring more turmoil to a two-year-old civil war. The announcement was made on a televised address in front of the flag of the former nation of southern Yemen. Now, it was 1994 there was a war, and the forces were defeated by the north and brought into a reunified country, but apparently it's time to divide it again now.
Well, Kevin probably has some comment to make about this, because this is your military career back in the 60s, isn't it? I mean, southern Yemen used to be a Marxist state.
That's right.
And, of course, then the north invaded the south and they became a single state. And
yeah, Kevin. Yeah.
But the civil war there was between factions within the country. And one of my lads once said to me, he said, you know, we're being told all these guys are Marxist rebels. He said, they're the first Marxists I've ever seen say their prayers five times a day. So it's
What do you make of this move to split Yemen up again then into north and south?
If it stopped the civil war, it would help. But I can't see it doing that.
No, I can't see it doing that either. And one of the things Jeremy Corbyn has pledged to do is stop supplying British weapons to Saudi Arabia, which are, in fact, Saudi Arabia is the most terrorist-inclined country in the world. There's no doubt about it that wealthy Saudis are the main funders of Wahhabi, Salafi, Takfiri terrorism in Syria and elsewhere. And they are our allies, and we work with them every day. And we are going to war with Syria if Theresa May wins the election, with Donald Trump. But we're not necessarily going to win, because it looks like the Russian Air Force and the Russian military are actually superior to our military, because they're fighting for the right. I'm not a pacifist. You're fighting for the wrong. You expect it. And we were mentioning earlier about the Marine in Afghanistan. Helmand Province is now 100% under the control of the Taliban. So every British life lost to try and take that province back from them was a life wasted.
Kevin, yeah. As someone that served in Yemen, what do you make of the present situation there? Any thoughts about how to sort it out with the blockade going on and the bombardment by Saudi Arabia?
This is in Yemen. Again, a ceasefire is absolutely essential. But can I take you just a tiny step? Trump is a lunatic, but he made a promise that, unfortunately, he would be able to keep, given American military power. He can defeat IS. But he needs the Russians to help him. I'm switching you from Yemen to Syria. But it's a promise that he can deliver. And this is very unsettling. A lot of people are going to get killed if he heads down that road. But he needs the Russians. So his kind of rapprochement with Russia actually made sense. More sense than his brain suggests. Very odd.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's obviously the whole geopolitical situation is in flux. But, Saudi Arabia invaded Yemen, effectively, and also invaded Bahrain during the Arab Spring. Now, when you cross international borders, like Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait, you then have a question, well, why is this being allowed? Why isn't somebody doing something about this? Not only are we not doing something about it, we are supporting. There are British military personnel based in Saudi Arabia today helping the Saudi military, who are all trained at Saudi Sandhurst to kill civilians in Yemen. Now, I'm not a pacifist. Maybe some fighting has to be done, and maybe some British soldiers have to die, just like in Afghanistan, where they shot that boy that we were talking about earlier. He was braver than many of the British soldiers who were there.
We've also heard from Jeremy Corbyn, haven't we, today, that he's not a pacifist either.
No, who's a pacifist, apart from Jesus Christ? And, of course, the fact is that we are on the brink, potentially, of a nuclear war, and we haven't really got round to discussing North Korea yet.
We're doing that any minute now.
But the danger is that we're in a... when we're talking about whether Jeremy Corbyn would use nuclear weapons first, and his answer, of course, is no, I wouldn't. But, of course, the threat made by Britain and America that they would use nuclear weapons first, and that they've deployed anti-missile systems in Romania and Poland, if you were the Russian general staff, you'd be preparing for nuclear war. Of course you would.
Well, let's talk about North Korea now. As Martin mentioned there, North Korea has accused the CIA of trying to assassinate Kim Jong-un with biochemical substances. The government statement claims the leader targeted during a public ceremony in Pyongyang. I mean, is this credible, do you think? Maybe you first, Martin.
Well, the idea that the Americans might assassinate people they don't like, they assassinate their politicians, US politicians they don't like, so that if they thought they could get away with it, they would. But the idea that killing this individual at the head of the North Korean structure would end the conflict is absurd. I mean, the North Koreans lost 20% of their population to Allied bombing during the 1950s. They are pretty, they don't have to have much provocation to fear what we may or may not do to them.
Also, Kevin, China is telling its citizens to leave North Korea as tensions with the US escalate. The embassy reportedly calls Korean Chinese residents with a warning.
Yeah. Trump is a loose cannon, and so is the guy in North Korea. It's a bad combination. And the Chinese will try and cool it. So that's what we should be looking for.
Well, Martin, it looks as if definitely the Chinese are sending signs to the world that they're not prepared to back North Korea in an unlimited way. There's also reports, this is from North Korea. North Korea say they could destroy the world with just three bombs. That's a regime apologist claiming that. Reclusive States self-styled special delegate says Korea is perfectly prepared with nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. This is an article in the Independent. Is there any truth to that, do you think, that North Korea could destroy the entire world with just three or four thermonuclear bombs?
Anybody who starts a nuclear war, even a minor nuclear war, there's going to be consequences. What's fascinating to me about this situation is the deployment of this so-called THAAD system in South Korea. Because, of course, that can actually designed just like the missiles in Romania and Poland for a first strike on China. It wouldn't actually work to try and stop North Korea because the missiles.
So are these missiles defensive?
No, they're not. They're not defensive. They're not perceived to be defensive by the Chinese general staff or the Russian general staff. But what's happened in the election, the presidential election in South Korea, is a moderate candidate has won, and he's saying, well, actually, we don't want this system. It doesn't protect us. But of course, he's got to try and keep on Trump's right side. I wish the newly elected president of South Korea every luck. He's going to need it because he's got to make Trump and Kim Jong-il see sense. And of course, the Chinese, obviously, they want sense as well. But this is all about creating tension with China and Russia. Ultimately, that's what we mentioned earlier, what drives Western policy. It's driven by armaments sales. That's what it's about. And of course, the danger with that is you end up fighting China and Russia rather than just getting loads of new weaponry to pretend to fight them, because wars have a horrible tendency to just spiral out of control once you've started them.
If you read Private Eye last week, real war would be a catastrophe for us because we've got about enough aeroplanes to fly for about 3 days. We have got.
Well, backing North Korea pretty much is China. And as I said at the top of the hour, on Dialect next Tuesday at lunchtime, we'll be hearing some pretty horrific things about what's going on in China, with prisoners of conscience having their organs taken out of their bodies and sold by the Chinese government. And let's have a listen now to investigative journalist Ethan Gutman. His book called The Slaughter, simply The Slaughter, is about this subject. We can hear more about this next week at noon on Tuesday on Dialect.
It represents a level of medical corruption that we have not seen since the Holocaust. A level of medical experimentation and the willingness to use lives this way. Now we have an ability to turn us into $200,000 and $300,000 worth of profit. That's what we're worth. It's not only real, it is state-sponsored. It is run by the Chinese government. And it does not just use regular prisoners, rapists, murderers, the like. It uses prisoners of conscience. We've reached a state of evidence. Now, if you are going to China right now to get an organ, chances are a perfectly innocent person is dying for you. 65,000 people over 8 years, political prisoners. It uses this massive prisoner population, particularly Falun Gong, as a source for organs. This is the only country where this is truly legal. This is it. China. Now, this is something we all want to neglect. We all want to turn our eyes away. We're not going to stop trading with China. We're not going to. China is going to be a player in the world. How do we square the China we know with what I've just told you? It is like finding out a relative of yours is a child molester. Now, you may have known they had some problems before, but now you know they're a child molester.
The reports into this estimate between 60,000 and 100,000 organs are transplanted each year in Chinese hospitals. This is done mostly for money. Martin, it sounds pretty horrific, especially when the people being targeted for it are people of faith and they're being told either you renounce that faith or we're going to take your organs and sell them.
Well, I know that in actual fact that they're talking about prisoners here. It's not necessarily political prisoners.
What they're saying in this report is it's prisoners of conscience.
Well, that's what they're saying. And yes. I'd also say that there's if you go to Latin America, you can buy organs that have been harvested. There's evidence that the Israeli occupation forces have done this in the West Bank. And I have to say that this kind of anti-Chinese propaganda.
Well, it's not propaganda, it's happening, isn't it?
Well, I'm not saying that it isn't happening. I'm just saying it's interesting that we're now talking about it now. Don't forget, you've got 1 billion people in China, so 65,000 transplants a year, or hostile transplants, or whatever. I'm not saying that there isn't some evidence there. The Chinese state is not entirely blameless structure. Of course it isn't. But then the US state isn't entirely blameless structure either. Why are we talking about this now?
Well, we're talking about it because I came across some people in the city centre here in Bristol who are concerned about it, and I think everyone should be concerned about it. Anyway, let's have a listen to Kevin.
No, it's I would be inclined to think about what Martin is saying because, if you like, I've got something, and it's not based on any conspiracy theories. It's very simple. And why are the American media not reporting it? It doesn't make any kind of sense.
Well, it might do if you
it does if Pilkington.
If you think to yourself, well, this is something that might be used as part of a psychological warfare campaign if there is kind of conflict breaks out. Finally, North Korea says it has the right to ruthlessly punish captured American citizens. There are at least four US citizens detained by North Korea, and they're saying they're going to punish them ruthlessly, Martin.
Well, there's clearly, there's an awful lot of propaganda going on all sides here, and everybody's ramping up the rhetoric. I think people need to actually think about the history of the original Korean War. It wasn't all one-sided. The West involved in massive atrocities against the population of both North and South Korea. One in five of the North Korean population was killed by indiscriminate Allied bombing carried out by the RAF and others. The North Koreans are not necessarily disposed to think of us as the good guys.
Yep. The volume of propaganda involved, it's very difficult to find out what is the truth.
Okay, so, I mean, what I'll do is I'll put a link up to this Australian news report, because the Australians seem to be rather more concerned about the organ harvesting than we do in Britain. And also, of course, there's a massive industry of organ tourism, which we go into on Dialect on Tuesday at noon. If you'd like to hear more about that, do tune in on BCFM 93.2. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests in the first hour That was Mike Campbell from Protect Our NHS, also to Sunday Times Rich List journalist, former Sunday Times Rich List journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Leave you with music from 1994. Yes, it's Johnny Violence. Do please join us at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.